Call this hearing the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is now 3:31, April 10th. Members present are Senator Hughes, Senator Giesel, myself, Senator Dunbar, and two other members are on away on other committee business, but they will be back soon, and we do have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to recognize Mary Gwen Kawakami, the recording secretary, and Dennis Fukushima from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have two items on our agenda. First is SJR 16, Foster Children Psychiatric Treatment, and second, a presentation from the Citizens Review Panel in response from the Office of Children's Services. I'll note that we did have Senate Bill 45 initially noticed, but we are still working. That's my bill. We're still working on it. We weren't ready to present today, so we will hear that soon. So our first item of business is Senate Joint Resolution 16. Senator Gray Jackson, the sponsor, and her staff, Deidre Goyens, are available. No, I guess it's not. It's a different presenter, but available. Mr. Bickford, please come forward. They will introduce the legislation, and we will hold invited testimony at a later date. So, Senator Gray Jackson, if you'd like to put yourself on the record, and please begin your presentation.
Senator L.B. Gray Jackson, representing District G in Anchorage. I want to start out by thanking you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. I'm here today to introduce Senate Joint Resolution 16, Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act, which would urge the United States Congress to support those experiencing congenital abnormalities and birth defects to be covered by private health insurance plans, which would cover diagnosis and treatment of their rare condition. Coverage must include services and items that functionally improve, repair, or restore any body part that is medically necessary for normal bodily functions or appearance as determined by the treating physician. In addition, the limits for coverage and cost-sharing requirements for such services and items may not be more than restricted than those applicable to all medical and surgical benefits under the plan. While this is a rare condition, hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, HED, still affects 1 in 20,000 newborns worldwide and nearly 200,000 in the United States. I believe that these treatments, no matter how rare and uncommon, should be covered by our medical insurance providers, and SJR 16 is a step in that direction. Hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia is also a condition that requires help from the dental community, given that this is a rare condition that limits one's ability to grow adult teeth. Currently, many medically necessary dental procedures are not covered adequately, if at all, which places a tremendous financial burden on families across Alaska and the U.S. In passing this resolution, the Alaska legislature would stand in support of families affected by congenital abnormalities and would urge the Alaska congressional delegation to champion this vital legislation. Accessing necessary medical and dental care should not be a privilege, but instead a right for all individuals, ensuring that families aren't forced to choose between financial stability and essential health care. And online with us today are families in Alaska who deal with this rare condition, who can offer a more direct perspective of their experience, as well as answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Are there any questions for Senator Gray Jackson, the sponsor? So we do, go ahead, Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm wondering, do we know if Medicaid covers this? Is this just something private insurance has? And I'm just wondering, I'm learning about it by reading, you know, learned the cost, and I'm aware of, I'm actually aware of it because many years ago, my son volunteered on the Mercy Ships, which spent time on the African coast, and a big part, it was a hospital ship, was doing these kind of surgeries for children. So I'm just wondering, does Medicaid cover this?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm not sure, but I'm sure that somebody online will be able to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Senator Hughes, we do have someone online, Ms. Emily Brubaker from Anchorage. Ms. Brubaker, are you able to answer that question? And then in general, do you have a testimony you'd like to give today?
Hello, my name is Emily Brubaker, and yes, I would be happy to answer that question. Currently, Medicaid does not cover any medical expenses that are for individuals in the United States with rare congenital anomalies, because it is most likely that these medical insurance companies will deem these procedures as cosmetic and therefore unnecessary.
Okay. And Ms. Brubaker, do you have other invited testimony that you'd like to present today?
Yes, I do.
Please put yourself on the record and go ahead.
When I was 2 years old, I was diagnosed with a genetic condition known as hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia. This condition affects my hair, skin, and teeth, and because of it, I will have to undergo many dental procedures
Ms. Brubaker,
to correct my teeth.
Ms. Brubaker, could you just pause for just a second? We're going to go off the record for a second. Technical difficulty here. We're going to go back on the record. I'm sorry, Ms. Brubaker. Go ahead.
Thank you. Should I restart?
No, you can resume where you were speaking before. Thank you, Ms. Brubaker.
All right. My condition, hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, affects my hair, skin, and teeth. And because of it, I will have to undergo many dental procedures in order to correct them. These surgeries will cost my family an estimated $100,000 out of pocket, but one law would change that. The Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act, or ELSA, would amend federal law and require private health insurance companies to cover the costs of medical procedures of individuals with rare congenital anomalies, like mine. As you can see, the ELSA bill would have a major impact on not only my family, but also thousands of other affected individuals and their loved ones across the country. I advocate for the bill on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., speaking with people like Senator Lisa Murkowski, Senator Dan Sullivan, and Representative Nick Begich about the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act and how it would affect their constituents. I've traveled to Washington, D.C. to advocate 8 times in person and numerous times virtually since I was 6 years old. In the 117th Congress, the ELSA bill passed in the House of Representatives with a bipartisan supermajority. The bill did not make it to the Senate, therefore, we are hoping that it will be reintroduced within the 119th Congress. Recently, in November of 2024, I was given a national platform to spread awareness about the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act through the National Civic Speech. Since presenting a speech about my advocacy for ELSA at the Bee and taking home the first place trophy, I have received overwhelming support from family, friends, and fellow Alaskan residents for the passing of the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act. I was incredibly grateful for the Anchorage Assembly's past resolution to support ELSA, and I'm also thankful that the Alaska Legislature is considering supporting the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act as well. This bill would deeply impact my family and families from around Alaska, as well as people across the United States with rare congenital anomalies. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Brubaker. Are there any questions for this testifier? I don't see any, and we don't have anyone else online for invited testimony. Senator Great Jackson or Mr. Bickford, do you have any closing remarks before we set the bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I really appreciate you hearing this resolution so soon, and I'm looking forward to it passing so that we can show support for the bill that's in Congress to help not just Emily but others who have this condition. So, again, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ray Jackson. We'll set this bill aside. We will have a public testimony at a later date. Take a brief at ease. back on the record. Our next item of business is a presentation from the Citizens Review Panel. Here to present is Tricia Minnick, coordinator, and Rachenda George Bettisworth, the panel chair. Are you guys online?
Yes, I'm online.
There we
this
go.
This is Rachenda George Bettisworth.
Thank you, Ms. Bettisworth. And is Ms. Minnick here as well?
No, she's not joining today.
Okay. All right. Well, I believe you have a slideshow presentation. Is that correct, Ms. Bettisworth?
I do.
Okay.
Do I just share that?
Yes. When you're ready, please put yourself on the record and start your presentation. I should note we also have online, we have Kim Koval, the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Family and Community Services, and Kim Gui, the Director, Office of Children's Services, who we will hear from after. Go
okay,
ahead,
Ms. Bettisworth. Do you guys
Bettisworth.
See my screen okay?
Yes, we can. Go
Thank
ahead,
you.
Ms. Bettisworth.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Rachenda George Bettisworth, and I am the current chair of the Citizen Review Panel. I reside in Fairbanks, Alaska. Thank you to the committee for their time today. And just to provide a little bit of background as to who I am, I'm in my fifth year of being part of the Citizen Review Panel in my second year as chair, and I am currently a faculty member at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, in the social work department. Today I'm going to be introducing the Citizen Review Panel, providing background on its formation, purpose, and functions, and giving an overview of our annual activities. Then I'm going to be sharing recommendations from our 23-24 annual report and walk you through our new two-phase work plan structure and focus areas for fiscal year 2025. So as you may know, Congress created the Citizen Review Panels as part of the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act to help child protection systems be more responsive to community needs. CRPs are a mechanism for public participation in child protection. They're intended to facilitate robust and meaningful participation by citizens to promote a healthy and collaborative child protection system. These are our federal mandates. So federal mandate states that CRP should examine the policies, procedures, and practices of state and local child protection agencies and evaluate the extent to which these agencies are effectively carrying out their child protection responsibilities. Conduct public outreach to assess the impact of current policies and procedures and solicit public comment on the panel's recommendation. The state mandates are similar, stating that the panel shall evaluate the extent to which the department is effectively carrying out its child protection responsibilities under the state plan submitted to the U.S. Department of Health and Social Services, child protection standards under federal and state laws, and any other criteria that the panel considers important to ensuring the protection of children. So the panel has three primary functions. First, as previously mentioned, we evaluate the extent to which state and local child protection system agencies in Alaska are effectively carrying out their child protection responsibilities. The CRP is independent of OCS, but it has a strong collaborative relationship with OCS, and both entities work closely together to target specific goals in relation to systemic challenges in Alaska's child welfare system. It is important to note that the CRP does not intervene in individual cases. We look for patterns that emerge across multiple cases to make recommendations aimed at improving the larger system. The secondary primary function is conducting public outreach and collecting opinions of various constituents on the child protection system. And our third primary function is conducting appropriate advocacy actions to help improve Alaska Child Protection Service System. The CRP does not lobby. We educate about our activities and priorities as a state board. So the CRP fiscal year starts on July 1st. We begin our work for each year by coming together as a group to establish our priorities and create our annual work plan. We work diligently throughout the year, meeting monthly to complete our activities. And by the end of May, we gather to close our year and prepare recommendations that are published in our annual report, which is distributed to OCS leadership and Alaska policymakers. OCS is required to provide a written response to those recommendations, and these activities are CAPTA mandated for the panel and OCS. So in the 23-24 annual report that was distributed in June 24, the findings and recommendations were focused on a healthy CPS system and panel engagement and development. Our findings and recommendations for panel engagement and development can be found in the annual report included in your meeting packet. Today, I'm going to be providing an overview of the recommendations we identified for a healthy CPS system, which focus on recruitment practices and prevention efforts. The CRP identified workforce retention as a key focus area in the work we did between 2021 and 2023, and hosted roundtable discussions with frontline child welfare workers, supervisors, and managers in each of Alaska's five regions. In 23 to 24, the CRP expanded that focus and received two presentations from OCS about the state's newly implemented centralized hiring system. So one of our findings, the CRP found that OCS is collecting data on process outcomes to monitor progress on their new HR hiring procedures, or which are a work in progress. And according to OCS, initial data indicated that the new HR hiring process was more efficient and centralized, but suffered some setbacks in staffing this department. And Director White can speak more on that in her remarks. Finally, the panel found that the state employee policies may not accommodate the diverse structure of OCS and more flexibility is needed. So our recommendations are that the Department of Family and Community Services needs to create flexibility to allow OCS to implement HR policies that support their complex scheduling needs. The hiring process needs to be attractive to potential applicants. And lastly, they need to allow for flexible working conditions within the OCS system. The CRP focused on prevention by exploring the policies and data related to screened out practices at OCS and practices around how families are referred to support services. So the child welfare intake screening process begins with reports of concern about a child's safety or well-being. These reports are carefully assessed to determine the level of risk to the child, and a decision is made on whether to screen the report in or out. So screened in reports refer to cases where allegations of abuse or neglect meet the criteria for investigation, leading to further assessment and intervention. And screened out reports are those that do not meet the required criteria. According to the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data System, 74.3% of screened in cases are children who have experienced neglect. It often takes multiple reports for a case to be screened in for neglect, providing an opportunity to support these families before them. Ensuring families have access to essential services like food, shelter, education, and health care can act as a protective factor against neglect. With that in mind, the CRP dedicated much of its efforts last year to understanding what happens after families are screened out and what the barriers are to connecting those families with prevention services. We found that policies regarding screened out reports could be more collaborative with community organizations to alleviate barriers to direct support after those calls are screened out. The panel suggested looking for examples from other states, placing OCS workers at community organizations, and working with the current administration to develop solutions and creating a report of their annual screened out case data for review. So the CRP has adopted a new structured approach through a two-year work plan that will be updated annually. Starting this year, the panel will prioritize focus areas critical to improving child welfare services in Alaska. The work plan cycle will span 2 years, and each priority will be organized into two phases. So phase one is education and knowledge building. In this phase, the emphasis is on deepening the panel's understanding of the selected child welfare topics. The cycle begins with the panel selecting key focus areas that will guide its efforts over the next 2 years. And in phase two, this is our action and implementation phase. So building on the understanding of gain gained in phase one. This phase focuses on translating knowledge into actionable strategies and initiatives to address identified issues within the focus area. This phase may overlap with phase one activities as the panel moves forward with specific actions to improve child welfare practices. And as progress advances, previous years may be built upon or other priorities may be identified. The panel will provide recommendations to Office of Children's Services in its annual report. So the panel's current focus areas are mandatory reporting and out-of-home placements. Mandatory reporting has been a central method for addressing child abuse neglect in the U.S. for 50 years. In Alaska, where child abuse neglect rates are among the highest per capita in the nation, many reports come from mandatory reporters. So these individuals, defined by state statutes, are legally required to report suspected child maltreatment to the Office of Children's Services. In phase one, the panel has collaborated with OCS to gather data on the efficacy and compliance rates of mandatory reporting in Alaska, focusing on the current state of reporting volumes and outcomes. And we have engaged with child welfare experts and examined the training methods provided to mandatory reporters to better understand the existing system, its challenges, and areas for improvement. We will continue to seek insights from the broader public and child welfare professionals to gather experiences regarding mandatory reporting processes to inform our recommendations in 24 and 25 annual report. And in phase two of our process, the panel has continued to work with OCS to explore screened out opportunities. These are cases that are reported but do not meet criteria for investigation to better allocate resources and ensure higher priority cases are addressed swiftly. We will continue to collaborate with community organizations to identify ways to involve the public in recognizing and reporting child abuse and neglect, potentially expanding beyond mandated reporters. And our second focus area is out-of-home placement. An out-of-home placement refers to the temporary care arrangements made for children who cannot safely remain in their homes due to abuse, neglect, or other safety concerns. Out-of-home placements in Alaska's Office of Children's Services include several options: kinship placements, where children are placed with relatives or close family friends; therapeutic homes that provide specialized care for children with emotional, behavioral, or medical needs; licensed foster homes for children needing temporary care; and residential services, including group homes and treatment facilities, who serve those requiring structured environments. So these placements aim to ensure the safety and stability of children while addressing their unique needs in alignment with federal standards for child welfare. So in one of this focus area, the panel will analyze existing data on out-of-home placements, focusing on placement stability, timeliness of placements, and long-term outcomes for children in care, and collaborate with OCS and service providers to understand the different placement types, including kinship care, therapeutic homes, and foster care. We're going to be looking to identify strengths and gaps in the current system, and given Alaska's diverse population, the panel will prioritize understanding the role of cultural and community connections in out-of-home placements. In phase two of this, this focus area will include action and implementation. So in the spring of 2025, the panel will develop a set of recommendations based on findings from our focus areas to be included in an annual report. This will include actionable steps for the Office of Children's Services to consider, such as enhancing the mandatory reporting process to ensure timely and accurate reporting and effective use of resources, advocating for ongoing training and education for mandatory reporters and caregivers. The panel will continue to hear from subject matter experts over the next few months, leading to developing recommendations for our annual report. Improving the well-being of Alaska's children and child welfare workers does not start and stop with OCS. It will take everyone working together to improve the child welfare system in Alaska. So I'll welcome any follow-up questions at this time, and our contact information is on the slides and in your packet.
Thank you, Dr. George Bettisworth. Are there questions for the presenter? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my question falls under the category
on page, I think it was slide 9, mandatory reporting. How much does the panel interact with the child advocacy centers?
We don't directly interact with the child advocacy centers. We may connect with them if we are asking for a presentation on services that they might do, but we don't directly connect to child advocacy centers.
Follow up?
Yes, and for the record, that was Dr. George Bettisworth. Senator Giesel.
Yes. So, Doctor, if the child advocacy centers closed, what would be the impact that the Citizens Advisory Panel, review panel, would envision?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, if I understand your question, if child advocacy centers closed, what would be the impact to the child welfare system?
Yes.
Is that correct?
And your review panel, your review panel's reports and evaluations?
Child advocacy centers are central to the work of keeping kids safe and keeping the system of investigation on those types of forensic cases. It's a best practice for everyone involved. So it would be a major setback to our child welfare system as a whole. I can't specifically speak to how it would impact the work that we do. It would be a major concern for us if we saw CACs close throughout the state, or if we saw a limitation of CACs, even a limitation of CACs, because there's been a major expansion of CACs in the last decade, for sure, across the state, which makes that process very seamless for children that have experienced major trauma. But I can't speak specifically to, it's not something that the CRP has discussed at this point.
One more follow-up?
Yes, Senator.
So, Doctor, there was some thought that the CRC or the Children's Advocacy Center, CACs, would be better situated under the Department of Public Safety versus the Department of Family and Community Services. Is that anything that the Citizens Review Panel ever discussed or contemplated?
Through the chair, that is not a topic of conversation we've had discussion about, and it's definitely something we could bring up in our next meeting or discussion for future work, but at this time we have not had any discussion in regards to that.
Thank you. I'll just make a final comment. I would suggest that the panel give more attention to the CACs. There are questions about ongoing funding, which would result in closure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and before I ask your question, first of all, thank you, Dr. George Bettisworth, for being here. My understanding is there could be a sudden drop-off of federal funds for the CAC. I met with folks from the Children Advocacy Center, the Children's Place in Wasilla, not too long ago. I am just wondering, in your screened out, those families that are screened out reports, are you aware, and I don't know if it's still going on, the ROC program in the Palmer-Wasilla area that Mattsu Health Foundation, ROC, R-O-C-K, Raising Our Children with Kindness, where those families maybe that was borderline, they were working with those families to try to help nurture a healthier environment so that the children wouldn't end up in the system. And typically when a foundation funds something like that, it's intended to be a pilot project that if it's successful, it can be replicated. Do you know whether that one was considered as a success and is an ongoing, and has the Citizen Review Panel considered recommending replicating that model.
The citizen review panel can make recommendations to replicate models that we might find as best practice across Alaska, but we don't look at individual programs that are occurring across the state. That isn't within our purview of work.
Follow up?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Professionally, I am I'm familiar with Rock Matsu, and one of our panel members is the previous executive director of Rock Matsu. So I'm familiar with it as an organization and have appreciated the work that they've done, but I can't speak specifically to what the CRP would do in this situation.
And follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my understanding, it's a partnership with OCS, and so it seems like there is a bit of an intersection. I would think that it would somewhat fall under your purview, at least to consider making a recommendation if it is something that would help our children that sadly fall in this category too often. The other thing I wanted to ask about whether it's been considered, if the review panel has considered the possibility, rather than pulling children out of the home and out of their familiar environment and the neighborhood, they're used to getting up and leaving for school every morning and just living, instead of pulling children out, pulling the parents out of the home. Has there been any consideration of that and putting, whether it's a relative or a caretaker in the home to try to disrupt the child's life next, as little as possible, since it's not their fault, the situation that's happening?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. Again, that's not something that we have discussed as a panel. So I can't speak to that. And I don't believe that OCS has the ability to remove parents from a home that they may own. So I'm not quite sure how that specifically would work. I do agree that as little removal and disruption in a child's life is best. So keeping them in places that are familiar to them and regular routine is always going to be the best option for children, as long as they can maintain safety.
And just a quick comment as follow-up. I think it is something that should be considered. It probably would take statutory changes for the ability to remove that parent, but I think it would be a very sensible approach. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I have one question, Dr. George Bettisworth. So, sometimes I think about OCS as, and we get obviously complaints from our constituents and about OCS. And sometimes I think, OCS could do a better job or what have you. And then other times I think, this is just an impossible job. They're just in an impossible situation. It's always going to be terrible. And I'm wondering, and it's a terrible situation in most cases, do you look at comparative data from other states? And relative to other states, sort of what is your either personal sense or perhaps the board sense from their annual report of, or the panel sense rather, of how we are doing relative to other states?
The panel as a whole has not done a comparison of how the state of Alaska child welfare system is doing in comparison to other states. Every state has a different system of work, right? They're all working under CAPTA, which is a federal regulation that each state implements and is individual in how they do that work. I would generally say, just because I have looked at the national data on child welfare and how children are doing through the child maltreatment report that comes out every year, that Alaska is pretty on par with what's going on across the nation. and we are doing we're screening out more cases in comparison to the national average. Whether or not that's a good or bad thing, I can't make a statement on, but I would not say that there's any one state that does child protection better or worse than us.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. George Bettisworth. All right. Are there any final questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your presentation today. And if you have any further comments or updates or you want to point us towards a particular part of the report, please do send us an email or have other folks from the panel send us an email. We very much appreciate your public service in this realm. And we will move on now to our next presenter. Thank you, Dr. George Bettisworth.
Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease. On the record, our final presenter today will be Director Kim Guay of the Office of Children's Services, Alaska Department of Family and Community Services, and Commissioner Kim Koval, also from the Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. I don't know, Director or Commissioner, which one of you will be running the presentation? Is that you, Director Guay?
It is.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you both for being here. And if you could put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Excellent, thank you. For the record, my name is Kim Guay. I'm the director here at the Office of Children's Services. I'm gonna do a brief presentation on a response for the Citizens Review Panel. I first wanna give a lot of appreciation and applause to the CRP. We do work very closely together in partnership and trying to make the system better in child welfare. And we spend many hours together in order to try to make some effectuate change. So I'm going to share my PowerPoint here, hopefully. There it goes. A few things that Dr. George Bettisworth mentioned was recruitment, retention, and then another one on prevention as far as screen outs and mandatory reporting. So I'm going to start with recruitment and retention here at the Office of Children's Services. She did mention our talent acquisition team, and so that's an effort that's happened in the department to try to streamline people coming to apply for positions here at OCS. And so what you see on the screen here is over time, who we're seeing that are applying for jobs. And so you will see more and more we are getting folks to within OCS with associates, high school associates and bachelor's degrees than what we've seen over the years. So we're seeing a little bit less education coming in the door at OCS. And so what that means is we train them differently, right? Like how do we bring people on board and onboard them to know what they're, how to do the job. And so that's been an effort, and we have seen some quicker turnarounds of getting people from an application into a seat on the job. So we did run into a little bit of stumbling blocks with the TA team, the talent acquisition team, as far as getting people hired and on for themselves, right, so they can start doing the hiring for OCS. And so we're back in the swing of it again, and I think things are working out with any new implementation. There's always some struggles. I also have some things on the slides here of different things that we're trying to retain staff, and that includes making sure that they get the education they need. So we are doing some paid internships. We are also paying for, we've worked in partnership with the School of Social Work, with UAA, and we're paying for staff to go get a child welfare certificate. So they increase their knowledge about families and children so they can do the job more comfortably. So a lot of things going on in that realm, which is all great news. I'm going to talk a little bit about retention here on the next slide.
Yeah, Director, I wanted to ask you, and perhaps it's better on the other side. I'm not looking on the slide. I don't see the number. I believe last year you had a number that you presented that had to do with the average sort of length of employment for an OCS employee, and it was shockingly short. Or I should say that there's a very small group of employees that have been there a very long time, But then the other employees, you know, and it makes sense why, but basically you had some of the highest burnout rates of any department in the state government. And I'm wondering, is that still the case? And sort of has that data improved at all? And I don't think I see it in the slide unless I'm misreading it.
Now, thank you for that question, Senator Dunbar. I don't have that data with me, but I can get that information for you about the length of time our case-carrying staff are staying with the agency. We have been seeing, at the height of the pandemic, our highest case-carrying turnover was 51%. We have seen a reduction. We are still sitting, though, at around 37% turnover within our frontline staff, which is way too high, right, which is why we're working on this. And our vacancy rate, for example, our Anchorage vacancy rate currently is sitting at 45% for case carrying staff. So, you know, you had mentioned earlier when Dr. George Bedesworth was up, is like some of the complaints that come into your office. And part of the issue is if we don't have people in the job to do the job, it's very difficult to do the job, right? And so we do what we have done to tried to strengthen that is if I don't have caseworkers, what tasks can be taken off the caseworkers and centralized, such as a placement search and support unit. So what I know is foster parents and relatives need support when children are placed with them, or we need to find relatives. And so we have created a unit that is assisting on those things because we know we have high turnover in our casework positions. And so there are different things that we're trying to navigate in order to try to get the work done. But with a 45% vacancy rate in Anchorage, for example, and statewide, we're at 33%. So for case carrying. So it's hard to do the job. We have PCNs. I have money in a budget. It's just we're not finding a lot of people that want to come do this work. It's we like to say it's heart work. It's also very hard work. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of people right now that they have other opportunities, and they're choosing not necessarily to come work for us. And if they do, not for very long. And so I will work on getting that number to you, though, on how long they're staying.
Thank you, Director. We have a question from Senator Klayman.
On that topic, you had mentioned turnover rate, and then you also seem to be talking about vacancy rate. I think of turnover more about how long is somebody there before they leave, and that becomes another vacancy. But were the percentage you were talking about, were those vacancy rates or were those turnover rates?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, they were both. So I did mention turnover rates, and I said we were at 51. We're now down to 37. So that is, and that's case-carrying staff, how often we're turning over within usually it's a year period. Our vacancy rate is how many people I don't have currently today in positions. So there's two different categories that I mentioned because they're both important to look at.
Well, yes, Senator Klayman.
So when you're talking about turnover, that's turnover in 1 year as opposed to just an open time period. When you describe a 37% turnover in frontline staff, that means you're essentially losing a little over a third of your staff a 1 year into their work.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
That makes sense because in theory, every agency has 100% turnover if you look long enough. All of us go retire eventually, God willing.
Not in the legislature.
Yeah. In 1 year to lose 51% of your staff or 37% of your staff, it makes it incredibly difficult to run any agency. So we appreciate it, Director. Senator Hughes, you have a question?
Yeah, I remember a number of years back when Representative Lascara was here, I thought we worked on reducing the caseload as a way to address this. I think we did. Do you have that history, and did that help at all by reducing the caseload as far as turnover?
Through the chair, Senator, I believe that was Hughes. Yes, that was House Bill 151 that was passed in 2018 by Lascara. I think it had great intentions, but what we don't have a turnoff valve here at OCS, right? So when children are in danger, even though I might have new staff, their caseload, we do try to cap their caseloads with the first 6 months that they're here. so they can understand, they can be trained, they can be brought on board in a slow manner so they can learn as they go. The problem being, if you're in, let's say, Utqiagvik, and I've got one worker because three other have left, they've quit, I have to serve families and children, right? I have a new investigation. I can't not do that. And so that we're not able to keep caseload caps because of our turnover. We do try and we measure that, and we're consistently looking at those numbers to figure out how we can try to achieve better caseload standards, because it's just not it's not doable. I refuse not to serve children and families to make sure they're safe in some capacity. So we really try, although not 100% successful in doing what we would totally like to do, which is way up here, you know, laying our eyes on kids and trying to do the best we can is sometimes all we can do, right? So we have to prioritize what we're doing, and caseloads sometimes go up higher than they need to be. For example, some of my seasoned staff in the Anchorage office, for example, are carrying 33 cases. The national recommended average is 12 to 13 cases. So much higher than the national average. But even I have supervisors carrying cases. You know, we try to do the best we can do with the resources that we have.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Senator Hughes, and then let's go on to the next slide.
So in that bill, I think we created more positions. I think that's the angle we went. And now with your vacancies, and if all those vacancies were filled, would you be down more at the national average in a more appropriate load?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, for sure. We would have a much more manageable load, around 10 to 14 cases per worker. The problem is people aren't applying for the job. They don't stay long enough. They're not, you know, according to what our surveys are saying, they're not paid enough to do this work, right? It's very difficult and challenging. And so caseloads and salaries is why they say that they don't typically stay very long. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Director. Let's go on to the next slide. I think we've got three left.
Excellent. So this slide is a little bit about, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I know we're pressed for time, but we have really been focusing on the retention of our staff, trying to make sure that our organization is healthy. And so what we do, we've got our staff at the center of our framework here. So we adopted a model from the U.S. Surgeon General around 4 years ago, trying to look at different avenues of making a healthy organization. And so this is kind of what's been suggested through the framework. And then I have in here just some things that we're working on, such as trying to create a career ladder, making sure that our staff feel safe emotionally and psychologically. We've stood up like critical incident debriefing. I mentioned heart work, right? We, you know, have children who pass away. Parents that are having a lot of struggles and, you know, incidents of aggression in the field that people are experiencing. So we try to make sure that they understand how we debrief these, how do we support them through these tough things. So there's lots of strategies that we're working on in our latest survey that was just completed a couple months ago, is showing that we're seeing a significant increase in our staff feeling like they matter at work. And so that's great news. And hopefully we'll see that in retention as well. But
good.
This is similar to what I had just mentioned. It's our workplace communication according to our survey. I do fireside chats every other month with all staff. We do a monthly frontline newsletter. We really are trying to prioritize hearing from folks. We have a staff advisory board. We have a supervisor leadership council. So we're really involving our staff in trying to make this a place that people want to work and where they feel valued. As Dr. George Bedesworth mentioned, the Protective Services reports, we receive around 21,000 calls per year, and 31% are screened in and 69% are screened out. And some of those are for a variety of reasons. And some of those, our jurisdiction, just a reminder, is household abuse and neglect. So if it happened outside the household, or it was a grandfather or a babysitter, we take that report and that information, and then we supply it to law enforcement or other agencies that serve those families. So that's part of the 21,000. Our jurisdiction is the 31% of those cases where it's familial abuse or neglect. And when appropriate, we also share our PSRs on Alaska Native families with tribes. And so many of them have confidentiality agreements that we've partnered with, and so they can also serve their families as reports come in.
Thank you, Director. I believe that's your last slide.
Yep,
could you,
that's
it. Could you go back to that slide, your final slide there? I have a question.
Yeah, let me pull that back up. I'm sorry.
No worries. And then if we get after the Director, Commissioner, certainly if you have anything you'd like to add, we'd love to hear from you. So my question is, and perhaps you don't need to pull up the slide. It's fine. I can just read off the slide.
Excellent.
So we understand that sometimes teams can be difficult to deal with. So you said you screen in – OCS screens in 31% and screens out 69%. How does that compare nationally to other states? Is that a typical rate? Do we have a – do we screen in or screen out at a higher rate than is typical nationally?
Right now, we are screening out a little bit less than the average rate. Usually, it's around 45%. So we are screening out more. One of the things that you have to look at, though, is what are different state screening laws. And, for example, our laws, if you're a mandated reporter, let's say four mandated reporters saw the same thing. All four people in Alaska are required to report to Office of Children's Services. Mm. In some states, one person is required to report. So that also accounts for the number of calls that we get and reports that we process. So a lot of it is dependent on what their statutes and regulations say.
Okay. And going back to our earlier discussion, for a case-carrying employee, what is a typical starting salary?
For Anchorage, which it does not have a geodiff, but for our Protective Service Specialist 1, they start off at, I believe it's $25 and some cents. I think maybe 30 cents, something like that. So it's around $25.
And what are the requirements for that entry-level position? Do you have to have a bachelor's degree? Do you have to have a background in social work? What are the requirements for that?
Thank you for that question, Senator Dunbar. Those were changed a few years ago. Right now, we have competency-based hiring. And so what that means is we could select 3 to 5 competencies that you're looking for in a protective service specialist, such as respectful communication, critical thinking. And then we base our questions on those competencies, and then they're part of the interview. So we no longer have a minimum qualification, such as a bachelor's degree or case management experience. It really is based upon how they display their competencies when they're being interviewed, or the reference checks and things like that.
Yeah. And I think this might be in what Senator Hughes was getting at as well, but $25 an hour, typical 40-hour week, that's $52,000 a year. I can say that's not enough to buy a house in Anchorage. It's hardly enough to rent a place in Anchorage right now. So it doesn't surprise me that it's difficult to recruit and retain at that level. And that's not your fault. That's just, that is just where we're at right now. And then of course there's no pension. We don't have to get into all that, but it's very, I would be hard pressed to find people that do this kind of work for that amount of pay. So.
And that is what they're saying in our staff surveys is, in Anchorage specifically, there's more opportunity for other jobs, right? And some communities where it's, there's not as many opportunities, so people will stay longer. But that is one of our struggles right now with Anchorage. Our other struggle is Western Alaska. Housing is an issue, right? I mean, they do get a geodiff bump if they're working in the rural locations. But we just can't find local hires. And so, we have instituted week on, week off, where our staff are flying in. Mm-hmm.
Any question? Any further questions for the director before we go to the commissioner? I don't see any. Commissioner Koval, do you have anything you'd like to add to that presentation or anything in general you'd like to talk to the committee about?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. For the record, Kim Koval, DFCS. I just want to extend my deepest gratitude to Dr. George Bebsworth and the CRP. We've had some really wonderful conversations with them and very good partnership, and we could look forward to continue that. And then also Composer Director Guay and the team at OCS. This, we say it all the time, this is hard work and heart work. Our staff really wear their hearts on their sleeves and do their utmost best. We also talk about areas where we can improve on those customer service skills and also how we are ensuring that families are getting the services and referrals that they need. There are a lot of pieces in child welfare that are not in our control, but there are pieces that we absolutely are working on. The talent acquisition team, which came out of Governor Dunleavy's People First Initiative, and supporting us. And we are the only department that is currently doing this initiative, trying to get that recruitment and hiring down at a much quicker and more wholesome rate versus what is normally seen as traditional state hiring. So we have seen really good improvements. We have seen better stabilization. And we certainly really appreciate the support of the legislative body in looking at our needs and how we're able to support our families. So thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, because I know you're aware of this, Commissioner, the issue that Senator Giesel raised about the child advocacy centers. Do you have any thoughts on that? You know, if the federal money doesn't come through, is there any way to for the state to continue to support them? You know, what would you see the impacts being if they were forced to close or reduce their services?
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. There are lots of opportunities that we're pursuing right now and looking at in regards to whether or not the CACs are quote unquote move to DPS or stay with DFCS. Truly, traditionally, we were the pass through for that those funds, those federal dollars. And we are currently right now looking at some other federal dollars and examining what a handful of other states are doing. So we're currently in that process right now. And there are some opportunities, but it is a very bureaucratic system that we're encountering in regards to how to analyze and apply what those calculations could be. But we are actively pursuing that right now. There are going to be some challenges going forward with some of the new priorities that we are seeing. But we also do recognize that we could not do this work without the CACs, that they do provide a very specialized training and workflow in regards to the needs of the families. And this is both custodial and non-custodial families we are talking about here. Not every family that utilizes a CAC come into our custody. So there are quite a few that do not remain with OCS or never touch OCS. So there's always going to be kind of that braiding between DPS and with DFCS, no matter where they're housed. So I hope that helps.
No, thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions for the commissioner?
Actually, yeah.
Senator Hughes.
Yes. So you said some of the CAC clients aren't coming from OCS. Could you give an example when a child would be brought to a CAC that you wouldn't have any contact or work with?
If the contact is not familial, meaning that the family was not involved in the contact, then that would automatically go to law enforcement, much like what Director Guay had referred to earlier in regards to screen and screen outs. So our statutory authority really looks at the family. It does not look outside the family.
Okay, thanks for that reminder.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Yeah. I don't see any other questions. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you again to the director. That is the end of our presentations today. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be Tuesday, April 15th. We will hear an introduction to SB 147. We will not be holding a meeting on Thursday, April 17th. In addition, I'll ask if anyone is considering amendments on SB 134, please let my office and legislative legal know by noon tomorrow, April 11th. Thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. The time is 4:31, and this hearing is adjourned.